I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The National Constitution Center announced today that it will award its 2016 Liberty Medal to U.S. Representative John Lewis. Jeffrey Rosen is president of the center. He also serves on the nomination committee for the award.
If there are civil rights icons in America, John Lewis is at the top of the list. He is the last survivor of the so-called Big Six, who were the civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King Jr., who transformed the meaning of equality in America. It is just extraordinary to have this living embodiment of constitutional equality, and we can't think of a more deserving recipient.
Lewis's leadership included speaking at the March on Washington and heading the march for voting rights from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. John Lewis recounted that experience to WHYY's Terry Gross on Fresh Air in 2009.
We came to the highest point on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Down below, we saw a sea of blue. Alabama State Troopers.
This march will not continue.
They came toward us, beating us with bullwhips, nightsticks, and releasing the tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going to die.
Rosen says John Lewis is an obvious choice for the award.
The goal is to honor men and women who have spread the blessings of liberty across the globe. And really, it's hard to think of anyone who's done that from a constitutional perspective more than Representative Lewis in terms of his leadership in the civil rights movement.
John Lewis now represents Georgia in Congress. It's a position he's held for nearly three decades. He'll receive the Liberty Medal at the Constitution Center in September. A new coalition is formed to push for changes in the way Pennsylvania draws legislative boundaries. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that a leading free market, limited government think tank is supporting the effort.
In Pennsylvania, the Republican-controlled legislature draws congressional boundaries. Democrats say their gerrymandering is why the GOP controls 13 of the state's 18 congressional seats. A new coalition called Fair District PA wants to amend the state constitution so that a nonpartisan commission would draw the boundaries for Congress and the legislature. It includes many groups labeled progressive. Also in the effort is the Conservative Commonwealth Foundation, a free market think tank. Coalition co-chair Carol Cunningholm of the League of Women Voters says that's a plus.
We are making a very strong case that this is a bipartisan issue, and I think having membership in our coalition from different sides of the spectrum makes that point clear.
Why would the Commonwealth Foundation support a move that might undermine Republican prospects? Vice President for Policy Nathan Benefield says the foundation has supported other good government reforms and believes a fairly elected citizen legislature will support its policy goals.
You see, you know, lower taxes, better spending, better policies in states that have more citizen legislatures than those with lawmakers who have been able to gerrymander districts.
Bipartisan bills in the legislature support the change, but Cunningholm says legislative leaders are leery. Coalition leaders hope public pressure will lead to favorable action this summer. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
It was a risky move. That's how Judge Elizabeth McHugh described the decision by prosecutors last week to not have Bill Cosby's accuser take the stand during the comedian's preliminary hearing. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is reviewing whether alleged victims can continue to skip testifying at preliminary hearings.
The case is about preliminary hearings. That's when prosecutors in Pennsylvania have to show that there was probable cause that a crime happened. If it's proven, a defendant is bound over for trial. There are usually witnesses who take the stand, and that's where the debate starts. Prosecutors say playing a tape of testimony from an accuser or having someone else read a statement is good enough. But defense attorneys say not so fast. How do you cross-examine a taped statement?
Look, you have a low bar. I mean, all we're asking, put the witness up there to say what happened.
Attorney Bill Costopoulos is challenging the current rule allowing second and third-hand testimony, also called hearsay evidence.
If a preliminary hearing can be conducted based on hearsay alone, then I don't know what you need effective counsel for at the preliminary hearing. Just mail us the statements and Davis the trip.
He says the defendant has the right to confront the accuser. It's a constitutional right, just like having a speedy trial and having the right to an attorney. That's true, says University of Pennsylvania law professor Stefanos Bibas, but the cross-examining is usually saved for trial, not before. He says there's a reason defense attorneys want to start the questioning early.
So the defense wants this as a preview so that it knows where to investigate and how to dig up dirt on the witnesses, et cetera. Otherwise, the defense may not find out these witnesses in the witness list, et cetera, until the eve of trial.
Bibas says trying to poke holes might result in some charges being thrown out, but that's rare at the pretrial stage.
Because, you know, the default of the judge is going to be, if I knock this out, there's at least a potential of my being appealed. Let me leave it till trial. The standard of proof is higher at trial anyway.
The state Supreme Court rejects 97% of cases at cent. So the fact that it's reviewing this one is significant and shows that the justices think there might be some room for debate. Attorney Frank Savone works with child victims of sexual abuse. He says he really hopes the court does not change the current rule. Sparing victims from questioning early on, he says, really is important.
Cross-examination is a kind of a shakedown. Everybody agrees that ostensibly the goal of cross-examination is to get to the truth. But we know as well that cross-examinations have the goal of creating confusion and indeed often to obfuscate the truth.
The High Court is expected to hear oral arguments on the hearsay rule this fall. Legal experts say it's very unlikely that it would ever affect the Cosby case. That would require the court to overturn the rule the court itself wrote and apply it retroactively. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Following Superstorm Sandy, U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan launched a design competition. Now, 2 years on, the successes of Rebuild by Design have in turn been used as a model for other processes. Let's check in with Amy Chester, Managing Director of Rebuild by Design. Amy, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about the process by which this coalition came together.
So after Hurricane Sandy hit the Northeast United States, President Obama appointed a task force of different government agencies on the federal level to work together. And that task force was headed by HUD, Secretary Sean Donovan at the time. And he really wanted to think about how do we build forward? How do we not just build back what was there before, but how do we build for the future, what our communities are going to need for the next generation? So he set aside some of the disaster recovery funds and with that created Rebuild by Design, which was a public-private partnership. Lots of NGOs were the partners, supported by private philanthropy. And what they did is they thought, how do we get the best ideas? So they created a design competition that would have implementable projects at the end. The call went out to teams around the world. 148 teams applied, and 10 were chosen, and they went through a 9-month process called Rebuild by Design.
And in addition to tapping resources worldwide, one of the keys is also focusing on community members to be part of the solution.
Absolutely. It was completely essential that we took the best minds and the best talent of the world and connected it to the best minds and the talent of the region, because it is the folks that live in the communities that understand best what their opportunities and vulnerabilities are every day. We didn't want to plan for just a one-time event like a Superstorm Sandy, but if we're going to be creating infrastructure solutions for the future, how do we make sure that those are solutions that also address today's other problems?
What are some of the tangible results on the ground?
Well, we have 7 projects that are funded right now that are being implemented. There are 2 in New Jersey. There are 3 in New York, 1 in Long Island, and 1 in Connecticut, and they're all really different. They go from being a comprehensive solution to resist water, delay water, store water, and discharge it for the city of Hoboken, which is the North Hudson plan, to an in-water solution, which the SCAPE team is working on offshore in Staten Island. Each of the projects are very unique, but also the same because they address more than just flooding. Some of the things that they address are new recreational space, new ways that the community can become healthy. So each of these interventions are very multidimensional and very exciting.
So now what's the focus of tomorrow's gathering called 2 years later?
So tomorrow we're bringing everyone back together, the design team members, the communities, the government agencies that have been implementing these projects, And we want to take a moment to celebrate and to reconnect and to think about how do we face these challenges. So these are large-scale infrastructure projects. They're going to take a long time to actually see a shovel in the ground, but there's a lot of work that's happening, and there are a lot of lessons that we're already learning. How do we capture those lessons for each other?
Amy Chester, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, too.
That was Amy Chester, Managing Director of Rebuild by Design. Still ahead this evening, a reality TV competition finds the right look for their set right here in Philadelphia.
We found this place and we said it's beautiful, it's perfect. We can light it and make it look absolutely gorgeous. It has a really good look at night.
We'll follow American Ninja Warriors there as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Rust Belt Boy is a new book about one boy growing up in one steel town in Pennsylvania. Though for anyone familiar with the Keystone State's boom and bust, the stories ring nostalgic and true. Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff revisits Ambridge, Pennsylvania with the author Paul Hertnecki to see how things have changed.
Everything you need to know about Ambridge is in the name. Once home to the American Bridge Company, the town sits about 15 miles north of Pittsburgh on the Ohio River. To an outsider, it looks like any former steel town. But for Paul Hertnecki, it's something else entirely.
Sons and daughters lucky enough to feel attached to a distinct hometown know it works its way under our skin and into our being.
Hertnecki is reading from his new book, Rust Belt Boy, Stories of an American Childhood. It's a memoir of growing up in a steel town as the U.S. lost its grip on the industry. Hertnecki, now in his 60s, is giving me a driving tour of what's left.
You know, I think we thought it would go on forever. The Vietnam War kind of kept it going strong for a while, but it was that last bloom before the fall.
Ambridge fell hard, and the signs are still there. The once vibrant downtown is quiet, the mills abandoned, and all signs of the American Bridge Company are erased, quite literally.
There was a massive building here until about 6 months ago, and it was the office building for the American Bridge Corporation. My father worked in there as a draftsman. And if you don't mind, I'm going to run in there and see if I can get an intact brick. Here's, you know, on this site is where draftsmen drew the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, the Empire State Building, the San Francisco Bay Bridge.
Now it's a pile of rubble, scrap metal, and smashed bricks.
This looks like a good one. Tall, anyway.
Hertnecki was an author with all these great Ambridge stories saved up, but he was hesitant to do anything with them. Then, in 2006, an Australian businessman investing in abandoned industrial sites came to town. Hertnecki, living in New Hampshire at the time, wrangled a lunch meeting.
And he asked for steamed milk and honey. And I thought, wow, milk and honey, that's what all these people came here looking for. And I looked into the German enclave and saw these are people who came in here in the 1800s looking to fulfill their vision. George Washington appeared. In the 1700s, he had a vision. J.P. Morgan came and bought all the rest of this in 1904, and he had a vision. And now maybe we have a fourth visionary.
While the Australians set out to make a new Ambridge, Hertnecki set out to remember the old. Each chapter of Rust Belt Boy weaves Hertnecki's personal experiences into the larger history of the town. A bar fight with a steel mill worker turns into a story about the union protests of the 1930s. Corruption and politics collide when the author spends a summer in Harrisburg working as a Senate page. And a mouth-watering chapter about pierogies is actually a reflection on the immigrants that built Ambridge from the ground up. As Hertnecki saw it, Ambridge was defined by those immigrants who arrived before him and the expats who left as he did.
You know, you could see classmates just disappearing and going away, going to California, going to Texas, going to Florida, going to the Carolinas. There was work, it was warmer, all those sorts of things.
Hertnecki himself went to Pittsburgh for college and, after returning for a stint in the steel mills, made his way to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where, he says, the sea made all the difference. He hasn't lived in Ambridge since, and though he's optimistic about the town's future, it's largely as an outside observer. Everything that has happened since Steele, the Australian slow progress on the old mills, the arrival of an Episcopal seminary, a small but growing antiques market, has been in his absence.
For 300 years, Western Pennsylvania, like the entire industrial heartland, was shaped by newcomers. To some extent, that's still true. But like never before, its vitality comes from those who have stayed.
By the end of the book, the Rust Belt boy, now grown up into a New England man, finds he can't shake the memories of the town and those still there.
Rescuing the Rust Belt, they are my heroes.
Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station project. This week, NBC launches the 8th season of American Ninja Warrior, a reality TV competition featuring amateur athletes. The season was taped in part in Philadelphia at an abandoned power plant in Port Richmond. WHYY's Peter Crimmins was there.
The course is under the Betsy Ross Bridge on a narrow strip of land between the Delaware River and the abandoned Richmond Generating Station. It looms like an industrial Greek temple. Executive producer Kent Weed looked a long time before deciding to shoot in Philadelphia.
We found this place, our location scout found this place, and we said it's beautiful, it's perfect. We can light it and make it look absolutely gorgeous. It has a really good look at night, and it's got history, you know, it's one of the oldest power plants in America.
Last summer, more than 7 million people watched American Ninja Warrior as runners tried to conquer obstacles like the floating steps, the log grip, and the warped wall. Contestants from around the world came to Philadelphia for a qualifying round. Finalists will compete for a $1 million prize in Las Vegas. One of them is an emergency room physician in Delaware County. His name is Dr. Richard Shoemaker. He's 40 years old with 4 kids, and he competed last year on a lark and made it all the way to Vegas.
But the best part about doing this and being an emergency doctor, when I see kids, the nurses tell them, you know, your doctor's a ninja. And it completely changes the dynamic. No kid in an emergency department wants to see their emergency doctor. And then when the nurse tells them, your doctor's a ninja, we high five, they talk about the show, and they're set at ease.
Shoemaker is competing against younger guys like Jamie Ron, who runs a parkour gym in Cherry Hill. He's been competing for 6 years, made it to Vegas 3 times, and this is the first time the taping has been in his backyard.
It's awesome that it's here. I can sleep in my own bed, which is very nice. And then more of my students are able to come, which is great. That love and support that you can feel makes a world of difference.
There are also cancer survivors, a star college football player who gave up the gridiron because of concussions, and a former stripper who is suing her former employer for back pay. One of the show's hosts, former NFL player Akbar Gbaja Biamila, says anyone can be the next American Ninja Warrior.
When you see people who've overcome cancer, who've overcome depression, alcoholism, you see them coming out here and having success, you go, wow, like, I can do this myself.
The Philadelphia episode of American Ninja Warrior airs June 27th. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And finally this evening, summer season notwithstanding, Philadelphians are about to get an incentive to bust out their lumberjack flannels. The city's about to become a national pioneer in axe throwing. Now, the sport involves throwing an axe at a bullseye on a wall. It's popular in Canada, but has yet to find a footing in the U.S. A venue called Urban Axes is looking to change that once they open this summer in Kensington. Visitors there will be able to get basic instructions from an expert and wield the sharp projectiles in no time. Now, according to Urban Axes website, beer and wine are allowed, but not to worry. The company emphasizes safety is their first priority. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. When it comes to presidential qualities, many Americans would like to see a commander-in-chief who can get along with both sides of the aisle. If a candidate's past political ties are any indication, the likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, might qualify on that count in New Jersey. As the Garden State's primary approaches, we'll take a closer look at those ties on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.